Farms versus Cargill, Mr. Aronson.
Good morning. We are here because the district court granted summary judgment to the defendants, despite evidence plaintiffs have presented, from which a jury could reasonably conclude that there was a conspiracy among the defendants to raise HFCS prices above the level at which they otherwise would have been, and to allocate volumes from 1989 through June 1995, which was enforced through interdefendant purchases. Plaintiffs presented five types of evidence. Plaintiffs presented evidence of an industry structure which was conducive to conspiracy, provided the fertile ground. Plaintiffs provided evidence of industry performance that leads to an inference of conspiracy and not to an inference of independent action. Plaintiffs presented evidence of actions that make no economic sense. Plaintiffs presented evidence that was direct evidence. And plaintiffs presented supporting evidence, which, perhaps not by itself, but in combination with other evidence, also supports an inference that there was a conspiracy in the high fructose corn syrup market. Turning to the evidence of the industry structure, that includes a highly concentrated market, a homogeneous product, little substitutability with sugar or corn syrup, inelastic demand, substantial barriers to entry, and centralized pricing authority. The evidence of an industry performance that leads to an inference of conspiracy and not to an inference of independent action includes abnormally stable market shares over the life of the conspiracy. Regression analysis by plaintiff's expert showing that there was a 15.7% increase in prices above where they would otherwise have been during the conspiracy, taking into account all relevant supply and demand factors. And the third is margin analysis by plaintiff's other expert, showing that during the conspiracy, the margins on HFCS 42 were 78.7% higher than outside the conspiracy, and on HFCS 55, they were 55.3% higher. The actions that make no economic sense include economically inexplicable interdefendant purchases and dramatic pricing changes that occurred after Terry Wilson became head of the high fructose corn syrup producing corn processing division at ADM. And as you, I'm sure, are aware, Mr. Wilson was convicted for his role in fixing prices in lysine, and also was the basis for ADM's plea of guilty with respect to the citric acid conspiracy. And a third...
Well, Andreas also, wasn't he?
Yes, Mick Andreas was as well.
Is he the son or the father? I forgot.
Mick Andreas is the son of Dwayne Andreas.
Right.
Dwayne Andreas was the chairman of the board for many years. Mick Andreas, at the time, was the executive vice president, and I believe he was the heir apparent as well.
So the son went to prison for the lysine conspiracy also?
That's correct,
with
Your
Wilson.
Honor. With Wilson. I visited them where they took the Fifth Amendment last year and refused to answer questions. Third set of actions that do not make any economic sense is that in 1989, prices were raised for HFCS above the level that would be justified by the increase in corn costs due to the drought. In 1994, prices were raised above the level that would be justified by corn costs due to the flood. And yet, in 1996, after the end of the conspiracy, when corn costs went up again, the price of HFCS went down. There's also direct evidence, and as we know from the brand name 2 decision, that means admissions or eyewitness accounts. There is an admission by Mick Andreas on one of the tapes, which said, in effect, that ADM had a deal with its two largest competitors to screw Coke. There is a statement by Staley's director of plant operations who said that there was an industry understanding not to undercut each other's prices.
Who was the fellow that said that the defendants consider their competitors their friends and their customers their enemies?
I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor. Well, that's in there.
Very nice line.
The person who said that was James Randall, who was the president of ADM at the time, in front of the lysine conspirators. That's one of our items of supporting evidence that in combination with others would lead to an inference of conspiracy. I would point out that there's more similar information to that. There is a statement in writing by Staley's director, Pierre Calabot, that says basically the same thing. We got to take care of competitors' happiness. It's at least as important as customers' happiness. And there is also a statement that indicates that Cargill's Ernest Mysick, president of the company, certainly in charge of the corn processing division there at the time, was in fact considered a friendly competitor by McAndrews. It's right there on the tapes. Going back to the direct evidence, there's one more I'd like to call your attention to, and that's a statement by Terry Wilson, again on the tapes, the day of the raid by the FBI, June 27, 1995. He wondered whether the FBI hit Staley. And of course, Staley did not make or sell lysine. Staley did not make or sell citric acid. But Staley certainly made and sold HFCF. Turning to the supporting evidence, there were frequent price verification calls by Terry Wilson. There's testimony to that effect. There were refusals to deal when there was excess capacity, especially Staley with Pepsi for 1992. There's also the use of the CRA data to monitor market shares. There's the use of the CRA, we submit, as cover for conspiratorial meetings, consistent with Wilson's statement on the tapes to lysine conspirators as to how to do it. And in addition, there is more evidence such as Cargill's document, will entrance play by the rules, and a statement by McAndrews on one of the tapes that Calabot was involved in industries where there were organizations which could be interpreted as conspiratorial organizations. I'd like to focus just for a minute on a couple of these matters, particularly the actions that make no economic sense. I referred to the interdependent purchases, which plaintiffs submit were the means, at least one of the means, of enforcing the conspiracy. We identified six of them, and they were economically inexplicable. They were economically inexplicable.
Because of the quantities?
Partially because of the quantities, because they were all above the purchaser's costs. They were all while the purchaser had excess capacity. The quantities, as Your Honor is pointing out, don't fit with the notion that there was a temporary imbalance, a rail car shortage, a derailment, or a product shortage, or an inability to supply a particular account. Those are the excuses. Just as an example, truckload is 400 hundredweight. A rail car is about 2,000 hundredweight. The purchases by Cargill from ADM in 1990 were about 805,000 hundredweight. That's quite a few rail cars, and it went on for 6 months. In 1991, the purchases by Cargill from ADM were about 258,000 hundredweight. That also went on for 4 months. The purchases by ADM from Staley in 1992 went on for 6 months, and that was about 865,000 hundredweight. That one cost ADM $7 million. But the point of all of this is that they were economically inexplicable, and they were by a purchaser who had gained market share the previous year. Except for ADM in 1992, which they pointed out, which is when ADM took over a large portion of the business that Staley refused to supply at Pepsi for that year. Now, I also indicated that there were dramatic pricing changes for 1989 after Wilson took over the operation of the corn processing division at ADM. And those included what we have called the 90% rule, pricing HFCS 42 at 90% of HFCS 55. And a study by Professor Rauser, a plaintiff's economist, showed that that rule applied to transaction prices, not just the list prices where anybody could see the 90% rule, but also particularly for the transaction prices. Then there was the institution of quarterly pricing, almost uniformly for 1989. That was announced first in September 1988 by Cargill. However, before that announcement, both ADM and Staley in their internal documents stated that we expect or anticipate that there will be quarterly pricing in the upcoming year. Further, Staley stated on August 17, 1988, we will support efforts to maintain quarterly pricing. Your Honor, I suggest that you can't square supporting efforts except supporting the efforts of others. And that indicates, and we believe it's a reasonable inference, certainly almost the only inference you could draw, that that means that Staley and ADM and Cargill had gotten together to agree to set up quarterly pricing for 1989 and thereafter.
Now, you said Wilson was head of the corn products division?
Yes.
Well, when was that?
He took over at the end of 1987, Your Honor.
Now, but he was also convicted for this lysine and citric.
Yes, he was.
So what's the connection?
The corn products division at ADM was in charge of both citric acid and HFCS. And for lysine, Wilson was called in to help out Mr. Whitaker, Mark Whitaker, who was the man who recorded the tapes for the FBI, to operate that conspiracy.
But citric acid is part of the corn product?
Yes, division. Barry Cox, who was in charge of the citric acid division, reported to Terry Wilson. I would like to turn now to some of the reasons that the defendants have given as to why there couldn't possibly have been a conspiracy here. And the first one of those reasons I'd like to deal with is whether tolling agreements could prevent a conspiracy. Tolling agreement is just another way of pricing HFCS. What it does is it shifts the risk of changes in the corn price over to the purchaser as opposed to the seller. It doesn't really make another difference, but it's hocus. There are references to the fact that they buy the corn, that is, the purchaser buys the corn, then it gets processed by the manufacturer. It really just is a shifting of the risk. The tolling agreement prices, however, versus the non-tolling agreement prices,
shift the risk to the purchaser because he owns the corn.
Because in theory he owns the corn. That's right. But the difference there with the tolling prices could be compared by the sellers. They knew the components going into both of them. It could be compared by the buyers because they knew the components and they could make the comparison. And in particular, some of the buyers had both kinds of contracts simultaneously. And that leads to the obvious conclusion that our economist drew in his report, which was that if you could compare it, if one was cheaper than the other, you'd shift. If you can compare it, as they all could, if you're going to fix one, you can fix the other, even though they may have been done secretly. And when he studied the correlations between the prices in tolling and non-tolling agreements, Professor Rauser found that they were correlated, and he so states in section 9.2 of his report. So the tolling agreements don't prevent a conspiracy. There was no discernible shift, and so it's not really anything that would prevent an inference that this conspiracy occurred as we allege it does. The defendants also argue that capacity was expanding and output was expanding, and therefore you couldn't have a conspiracy here. Well, first of all, if we take a look at the capacity expansion, you will note that at least part of it was in anticipation of a new market opening up in Mexico as a result of NAFTA, which was passed in 1993. Secondly, if you take a look at the relative expansion of capacity among the defendants, it's basically level for all of the defendants except ADM. ADM grew its capacity disproportionately. And I submit that that's consistent with an inference that it was there as an overhang to prevent anybody from leaving the agreement, the conspiracy. Because if you did, ADM would come in with all its excess capacity and blow you out of the water, undercut prices, and outsell you. And so, therefore, in fact, that helps us. With respect to the expansion of the output, that's certainly true. But that's one of the amazing things we've got here is the stable market shares. For 6.5 years, under the test favored by defendant's expert, Professor Elzinga, to determine whether there were stable market shares, he found that if you take the coefficient of variation, which is what we've been calling the Jacobi test because it was in an article by Henry Jacobi first, that if the coefficient of variation is less than 7, According to Professor Elzinga's article in the Antitrust Bulletin, that would be grounds for prosecution by the Antitrust Department. And after you take into account the interdefendant purchasers, all of the defendants had coefficients of variation less than 7. And before you take that into account, they all did except for Staley. And of course, Staley had this Pepsi situation, and ADM bought a lot of product from Staley in 1992 and 1993. So we submit that, in fact, the expansion of output supports our analysis that there was a conspiracy here and that the court was wrong to prevent us from taking the issues to the jury. A third argument that the defendants make is that there were lists and not transaction prices that plaintiffs allege were fixed here. And that's just not true. As I've already referenced, we allege that the transaction prices for HFCS 42 was fixed at 90% of HFCS 55. We also have evidence from Professor Rouser's analysis that list prices were correlated, in fact significantly correlated, with transaction prices for all of the defendants across both products, HFCS 42 and HFCS 55, except with respect to American Maize for HFCS 55. And of course you've got the regression analysis that shows that the prices were 15.7% higher than they otherwise would have been.
Now, is Rausner's report deemed admissible, or?
Well, I think it's part of the record on the summary judgment, Your Honor. There was a motion in limine that was made concurrent with the motion for summary judgment that's to strike the report by the defendants. That was denied by
That's your motion, but I mean you're...
No, not our motion. The defendants moved to throw out Professor Rausner's report.
Oh, no,
that motion was denied. And that
was denied. Oh, because Rausner, okay, okay, part of your appeal, you're objecting to James's report.
Yes, Your Honor. We did to a portion of James's report where he attacks Rausner's regression because he throws in corn syrup prices even though there's no basis for doing so because it's not a supply factor, it's not a demand factor. It doesn't reflect market structure. James, in fact, testified that he didn't study the common factors between HFCS and corn syrup prices. And further, what he relied on, which was the USDA report, doesn't even mention corn syrup prices, it only mentions sugar. So we think that should be tossed out. And that is part of our appeal as well. And there's also an appeal with respect to Professor Tappell's report, where he used a benchmark profits test, which he admitted his deposition you can't do. It doesn't exist because it's an oligopoly and you can't predict where the margins will be vis-a-vis a particular level, even using a Cornell model. Your Honor, there are also some issues with respect to the evidence that was rejected by the court, particularly with respect to the tapes and whether they should be admissible against Cargo, Staley, and American Maize. Those are declarations against interest. The district court, for whatever reason, never even considered the argument we made on that score. Certainly didn't write about it, though we made it. We submit that that should be reversed. There's also the question of the inferences to be drawn from the Fifth Amendment invocations. We think that those are reliable enough because they're backed up by other evidence, particularly evidence that was asked of the people invoking it. I asked many of those questions myself. Putting them in the background, such as with the price verification calls, I put the testimony by Mr. Kremers saying that there were some price verification calls. I, of course, asked Mr. Wilson, did you make those calls? First I asked him, was that accurate testimony? Then I asked him whether he made the calls, and he took the Fifth Amendment. I think we're entitled to an inference that there were such price verification calls at this time. They're equally trustworthy against the other defendants as against ADM because they were basically co-conspirators, as we demonstrated. And so I think that the district court made many errors here. It should be reversed. Summary judgment should be granted, and the other aspects of it should be reversed as well. Thank you for listening.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Aronson. Mr. Shapiro?
May it please the court, Steve Shapiro on behalf of the defendants. I should remark first on a number of counsel's points about the evidence. He noted that the transaction price, in his view, the transaction prices were parallel or fixed in nature. They were never parallel. They were never even close to each other.
That was one of a number of puzzles I had in your argument. It's illegal to fix list prices, even if you don't charge them. Your position in your brief seems to be not that there wasn't a conspiracy, but that it didn't have any significant effect on the actual behavior of the parties.
Your Honor, our submission is that there was no agreement whatsoever.
No, but you agree. If they agreed to fix list prices, it's not a defense that they then gave discounts.
Oh, we would agree that if there is proof of fixing prices, list prices that hurt somebody, yes, they
no,
they
no,
got
no,
protection.
No. Hurt somebody is completely different.
I agree.
If there's proof that your client fixed list prices, that's a violation. And the next question is there any injury, any
yes,
damages?
We agree with that, but there is no evidence whatsoever that there was agreement concerning the list prices. And we refer to the variation in the prices.
Well, that 90% thing is hard to explain away.
Well, Your Honor, the 90%...
Plus the fact, of course, you have all these remarkable quotations. This business about our competitors are our friends and our customers are our enemies, I've never seen something like that in the case before.
Well, Your Honor, what he was referring to, and we have to speculate, but
Wait a second. What do you mean we have to speculate? We don't speculate when we're doing summary judgment. We let the jury decide what they mean.
Our point is that that's an utterly ambiguous statement.
That's fine. It's ambiguous, but then you let the jury disambiguate, don't you?
We don't.
Together with all the other evidence.
Under Matsushita, right? A case that is ambiguous where the inference of collusion is not more reasonable.
That's a case about the economic evidence. That's not a case about... If someone admits we're fixing prices...
This is anything but an admission that they're fixing prices.
I don't understand.
Prices.
What does it mean to say our competitors are our friends and our customers are our enemies?
What it means is that the buyers here had huge power and were taking their pound of flesh in negotiations. They were aggressive, sophisticated. They got discounts of 30% to 40% on these list prices, and they were driving these prices down to the level of marginal cost. That was the reference. These are very tough, aggressive people on the other side of the table. The reference to our competitors is simply a reference to oligopoly. It's a fact of life that in oligopoly markets, the sellers are interdependent. There was no reference to Fructo.
Friends, it means they compete along other dimensions. I mean, everyone knows, you know, the automobile industry is oligopolistic, but they compete fiercely.
There is fierce competition here.
But also, let me just add a factual question. Yeah, we know there are big purchasers like Coke and Pepsi. Are there small purchasers, or
is
it just Coke and Pepsi?
Coke and Pepsi purchase 70% of the 55 product, and their large purchasers purchase, 10 large purchasers purchase a half of the 42 product. And the smaller purchasers are banded together in cooperatives, and
well,
they
may be banded together, but it's very, I mean, we just had this prescription brand case. It's very common in a conspiracy or any situation for the large purchasers to get discounts, the small purchasers to get screwed. So the fact that Pepsi and Coke may get discounts, that doesn't really, that means Pepsi and Coke might not have any damages, but I don't see how it bears on the...
Well, virtually everybody here, Your Honor, got discounts. You'll see that the transaction prices...
What difference does that make? Everybody got discounts? Then why do they have list prices?
List prices were just a beginning point in the discussions. They showed market trends.
Well, if they're a beginning point, then they influence price.
Well, the buyers said that, no, they had nothing to do with the bottom line.
Then why do they charge the list price? It has no effect on the
buyers said that the list prices were useful in just figuring out trends in the market. And they also announced the beginning period for these two-week negotiations that went on. They commenced the negotiations. And during these negotiations, one seller was played off against the other sellers to get the discounts that the buyers wanted. And huge market shares changed hands here. We're talking about a situation where Cargill went from 21 to 27% of the market. That's a 30% change in the market. If General Motors picked up 30% market share, they'd be dancing in the street.
This fellow Wilson, who was fixing prices for lysine and citric acid, and he's got the HFCS under his wing too. Why wouldn't he want to fix prices for this also? Why would you just want to fix? What's special about lysine and citric acid?
Well, the difference, Your Honor, is that there was specific evidence of price fixing to the penny and market allocation to the ton in the case of lysine.
There may be
and
more evidence,
acid.
But the question is, why, from Wilson's standpoint, would he turn honest suddenly when he's dealing with the HSCS.
Whitaker did his darn best to get some confession from somebody.
Answer my question. My question is there some difference between lysine and citric acid which would make it logical for Wilson to draw the line?
Well, they're tremendous differences.
The conspirators were primarily foreign corporations.
Yes, Your Honor. These were cartels overseas among Europeans and Asians that ADM belatedly joined. Now, in the case of Fructose, we have all American companies, and they're operating through a legitimate trade association that's existed for 100 years. And Whitaker attempted to get some confession. This is a real reality check on this case. He sat right next to Wilson and Andreas for 2.5 years, and he baited them, he pleaded with them to say something incriminating about Fructose. They talked freely about the others, but not a word about Fructose.
They said they had a deal to screw, actually word is stronger, but I'll avoid it, Coke.
Yes, Your Honor, if this is a boycott case by Coke, that might have some pertinence, but it is not. And what was going on was a venting of frustration by the ADM people.
That's your interpretation. When you say what's going on is a venting of spleen, but that's an interpretation. Don't we let the jury put together all this evidence? Every little bit of it may be ambiguous, but when you put them all together, it's a strong case.
I think it's a truly a case of nothing plus nothing equaling nothing.
You can pick at little things, but take this point about how Wilson wondered whether Staley had been raided by the FBI, even though Staley doesn't produce lysine or citric acid. Now that in itself doesn't prove anything, but isn't that another brick in this wall?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Staley was never raided by the FBI or by anybody else. It was never accused of price fixing
market. That's not.
And why was the question raised? Because these two companies were both in Decatur, and FBI agents were all over Decatur. And Wilson was wondering, what's going on? What is the scope of this?
He didn't say why was Walmart raided. Well, it might be a Walmart indicator.
He simply didn't know the scope of the investigation. So we submit
that's your interpretation.
Yes, but these tidbits are all ambiguous. Take the statement about Coke. It was just a question. What are we supposed to do? He said.
But you agree, don't you? A bunch of ambiguous tidbits can add up to a case that a jury could find by a preponderance of the evidence.
Well, if each piece is ambiguous, and in this case at least, the sum total is ambiguous, when you have aggressive competition shown by the turnover in market shares, you have the deep discounts negotiated by these buyers, you have confidential negotiations.
Some buyers get this.
And where are the fixed prices? It's like a murder case without any corpus delicti.
The 90%.
That had nothing to do with the transaction prices.
Now you're back to that fallacy that only transaction prices count. We were just talking about list prices. If firms get together and agree that one product will have a list price 90% as large as another product, that's price fixing.
I agree, but there was no proof that these defendants consulted with each other about the 90% formula. They were simply copying a formula that made perfectly good sense for each of them individually.
What sense? I don't understand. It seems completely arbitrary.
There were different margins earned on these two products, and ADM decided it would bring the margins up to the same thing.
But the ratio wasn't at 90%.
But yes, it was. The sweetener additives were 90%. The solid additives were at a 90% ratio, and that's why some of the other sellers copied that formula. And still, one other company, Mays, said we copied it because we're the small seller. We follow what the market does. Each company had an independent explanation for this, but that's just what you would expect with independent competitors. Now, I'd like to stress that the fundamental defect in this whole theory that the court has just heard about is that we have actual conduct by the buyers and sellers that is really inconsistent with the claim of collusion. I remember Your Honor's article in Stanford in 1969 focusing on actual cartel-like behavior. We simply don't have that, and we don't have any evidence of any mechanism that would make this scheme work. Counsel refers to these intercompany sales. Well, those took place before the alleged conspiracy period. And in addition, they were in magnitudes that came nowhere near matching the changes in market share. When Staley lost 700 million pounds of business and fell from 23% down to 16% market share, the transaction it had was 10% of that huge loss of business. And these sellers didn't even know what changes in market share were taking place with each other because they had no way of getting that information. The CRA only gave them aggregate information, nothing about individual company shares. So there's absolutely no way to police. And Professor Stigler,
you're making a good argument, but it's an argument to a jury because, you know, there's evidence on all sides. Were these market shares fixed? If you go through now, Professor Rausner. I mean, of course, you have your experts who throw darts at him, and then they throw darts at your experts. But if you just, I did look at Rausner's report. It's lucid and it's logical, and so I may be wrong. But it is an admissible document, and if the jury believed what was in there, they'd say, yes, this was certainly a price-fixing conspiracy.
In every one of these cases, including Matsusha and including Brook Group, there is an expert that offers a similar opinion. And in this case, what Professor Rausner did is to look at these same bits of evidence that the district court analyzed so carefully, and he concluded this adds up to a contract combination or conspiracy. Well, that is not within the toolkit of an economist. This is something Professor Stigler has written about in What Does an Economist Know? It's not an economist's job to read through a stack of documents and say they look suspicious or that he doesn't think that...
He didn't just do that. He has a lot of statistical evidence that he compiled, and he concluded, not that there was a violation of law, but in fact, these companies had gotten together and agreed in this period to charge fixed prices and their margin and their, you know, profits had increased and so on. And I mean, you may be wrong because you have your own experts, but I don't see how a judge can just throw out, and he did throw out Rausner's report. He didn't say it was inadmissible. So there it is, a huge mass of economic evidence bolstered by these admissions.
That was true in Matsushita. The expert opinion was admissible, but it was legally insufficient to go to the jury. And that was true in the Brook Group case, too. And the problem with Rausner's opinion...
You know, but Brook and Matsushita are cases where, because of the peculiar circumstances, whether it's the predatory pricing in Brook or this notion that a conspiracy to predate is just very hard to imagine because you have to agree first to raise the price, they have to agree to lower price. That made those cases, suspicious. But this isn't, there's nothing exotic about fixing prices. These same people fix prices in closely related products made by the same company. So there's nothing implausible about a price-fixing conspiracy here. There's just a huge mass of evidence on both sides.
Well, this is very much like reserve supply. There were three sellers of 90% of the market. The product was fungible. There was inelastic demand. The claim was that the profits were too high and the output wasn't sufficient. And an expert gave an opinion that this was...
They didn't have these admissions. And the fact is, you take something like the inference from taking the Fifth Amendment. I don't understand how the judge can disallow that. These people are asked about this product. They take the Fifth Amendment. In a civil case, you can draw an adverse inference. Now, you have a theory. They had reasons for taking the Fifth Amendment that were innocent. Well, you can explain that to a jury. That just becomes one more of these bits of ambiguous evidence.
We think this was a discretionary judgment by the trial judge under the precedence that this was not trustworthy under these circumstances because the witnesses from the four other companies, none of them pleaded the Fifth Amendment. They all answered truthfully all the questions that were presented to them about fructose. And this is supposed to be a five-way conspiracy, not a one-way conspiracy. And all the other witnesses answered. And the two people that did not answer had very good reasons, apart from fructose, not to answer those questions. They were exposed to criminal liability for lysine and citric acid. So under these circumstances, the invocation is extremely misleading and ambiguous.
Why is it, but if you can explain that to the jury, so why would they be misled?
The case law that we've seen says it's up to the trial judge to determine whether it's a trustworthy inference at the threshold. And we think here he had good reason for discounting the invocation of the Fifth Amendment. There was so much other evidence that the plaintiffs had. They had 150 depositions here. They saw millions and millions of documents. and they had the benefits of this 2.5-year intensive undercover government investigation, but none of this evidence bears on fructose. There's talk about lysine, there's talk about citric acid.
When were those questions posed, at what point, after they'd been convicted?
Yes, there were three depositions of each of these, and the last one that counsel's referring to took place when Wilson and Andreas were in jail. But they were
prior to their petition for rehearing with regard to sentence.
I believe that's right. But they were still exposed to further liability, Your Honor, at the state level and for citric acid. There was no promise not to prosecute them, so they pleaded the fifth on a blanket basis. But they had very good reason to do that apart from fructose. Now, I think it's important to focus on this Jacoby index and the turnover ratio that counsel is talking about. There are huge turnovers in this market.
Would it be sensible in a case like this to have the expert from both sides to agree on a neutral expert? Because judges and juries can't figure out the details of these statistical battles among the experts. Well, technical mumbo-jumbo. Isn't that a good way to go in a case like this?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Under Reserve Force and Brook Group and Matsushita, there's an initial inquiry whether the market facts themselves will support the expert's opinion. It's not enough to just provide a bottom line.
But you said you wanted to talk about this Jacoby test.
Yes.
And my question is, if experts get into a hassle about statistical procedures, why doesn't it make sense to have the experts from both sides designate a neutral expert whom the court would then appoint as its expert, so that the judge and jury have the benefit of neutral opinion on these very technical issues?
Well, first of all, the Jacoby article itself says that it can't distinguish.
Do you want to answer my question?
Yes, I think that would override the value of summary judgment in big cases like this, which the Supreme Court has been stressing is quite important to the administration of these cases. And here there really isn't any difference on the point I was talking about. Jacoby says he cannot distinguish between price-fixing cases and oligopoly cases. But that's just what this case requires the court to distinguish between. And Professor Rausser, he said it's very difficult to distinguish between them, and I just think there was some understanding in this industry. Not that there was an agreement to fix prices. He said there was no such agreement. There was no agreement to allocate customers. There was no agreement to restrict output. He just said these competitors knew a lot about each other's strategies and counter-strategies, but that's just the definition of an oligopoly.
So now you've made two opposite arguments. One is that they're fiercely competitive, one is that they're oligopolistic and so don't compete.
Well, some oligopolies produce very competitive low prices, and here the big buyers said these prices were down near marginal cost. I know there are different theories of oligopoly pricing, some with high prices, some with very low prices. And in this instance, the record shows that the prices were coming down in four of the 3 years. There was no pattern to the prices. The market shares were changing dramatically. You had confidential negotiations.
Wait, your opponent says the market shares were not changing.
He's quite wrong about that. His own expert computed the market shares. Cargill went from 21% to 27%. That's a 30% increase in this time of supposed allocation of market share. And ADM went down 25%. And if you look what happened to Staley, they went from 23% down to 16%, a 30% cut. Those are huge changes in the shares of these businesses. And why did that happen? When Staley was charging $16.50 for its product, its competitors came in at $15 and $14 and took away 700 million pounds of business. Is that a market where the prices are fixed or where the shares are being allocated? The conduct is completely inconsistent with this theory. And I'd like to just refer to, if I may, to counsel's comment that the CRA was used as a cover for conspiracy. This was a trade association that had an attorney from Winston and Strawn sitting there at every meeting of the board of directors, at every committee meeting, and at the social events. And there were people at CRA who are not members of this purported conspiracy.
Well, he said that's why they'd go into the back room and talk among themselves.
If there was a tidbit of evidence saying that, that would be an interesting argument, but there's none. And Whitaker was looking for that evidence for 2.5 years. There is a reality check on this case.
Are you saying there were no private conversations?
Non-concerning fructose price fixing. There's not a syllable of evidence on that issue. And what is the importance?
No, but you started to say there were no private. There was a lawyer present every time the competitors talked to each other. You don't mean that.
At the board meetings, at the committee meetings.
But when they had their meetings, these people could and did talk privately without the presence of the lawyer.
Oh, of course. And our friends speculate that on those occasions there was price fixing going on, but there has to be some evidence of that. And Mr. Whitaker recorded on 200 tapes trying to find some evidence of that sort, and he couldn't find it. And ADM cooperated with the government in its grand jury investigation. After its guilty plea, it turned over every document that it had, and it made all of its witnesses, all of its employees available to the government. Still nothing. So after 2.5 years of this intensive government investigation and the grand jury investigation, after 150 depositions and the production of millions and millions of documents, all we have is this tiny pile of what I submit is extraordinarily weak and attenuated and ambiguous evidence, none of which says that there was any price fixing going on in fructose. And that is just so different from what we had in citric acid and in lysine, where there were schedules of prices to the penny, and there were schedules of tonnage down to the product down to the last ton. That's just what's missing here. And there was a mechanism to see what everybody's market share would be and to see if there had to be a compensating transaction. When counsel was asked in the district court, did they get any information that would permit them to monitor those shares? He said, no, there's only aggregate information here. And then when he was asked...
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to run over a little. Mr. Aronson, how much time does he have?
I'll try and be quick, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Time goes fast when you're having fun. So.
I know that.
Zero ran over, so we'll give you a full 2 minutes.
Appreciate that. Let me first of all start with Terry Wilson. When I took his deposition in Duluth at the prison last year, it was February 7 and 8, 2001. Also, I took the deposition in McAndrews then. That was after the cert petition had been denied. Secondly, Mr. Wilson, on tape, said it's easier to keep track and do a conspiracy in fructose. It's on the tapes. He said that to the lysine conspirators. Third, with regard to, and that of course covers why it's Americans and not Europeans, it's easier to do there in HFCS.
They were Asian.
Pardon?
Asian.
They were Asian, but there's Europeans in citric as well. Whitaker was not involved in HFCS. That's why there are no tapes. But there is at least one tape. We've got a full tape of the discussion in the executive dining room, and that's where McAndrews made the statement with regard to screwing coke. With regard to the Fifth Amendment invocation, Barry Cox is immune, and he is one of the people we're seeking to get inferences from. So he was not just one of those people who was convicted. With regard to large buyers, let me say that they did have problems here. Take a look at the evidence of Mr. Reese. Koch had terrible problems in his negotiations for 1994. He suspected that they were coordinating their responses to him. It's in the record. With regard to Pepsi, in 1991, they had a problem with ADM. ADM wouldn't provide them the product. Pepsi had to start using sugar, which is a disaster for Pepsi, and they only got it straightened out after there was a meeting between Duane Andreas and the president of Pepsi. Further, there's a correlation. Professor Rauser has run them between the large and the small buyers, and it turns out that the prices are correlated. If their prices are correlated, there was a fix-in, it affected both of them, even if it was true that the large buyers had a lower price.
What about Mr. Shapiro's point about how the market shares jumped around?
Thank you. Let me tell you what he's doing. He's starting with the year before the conspiracy started, and that's what he's comparing the numbers to. Let me give you some examples about that. ADM, this is what we ran the Jacoby test on, 89 through 95. And I'm sorry, it's numbers, you'll have to listen, I'm trying to speak fast. 28.93, 28.22, 25.29, a down year.
All of those figures are in your brief.
Yes, they are. But okay. The point is that ADM's at 28 the whole way through. Staley, yes, it had a down year, started at 2015 in 89, ended at 20.70 in 1995. Cargo, first year 22.37, and then it's even at 25.
Okay, we'll
there. So, and I also want to make one more statement.
All right, one
I'm sorry, one more statement. I want a quote from a tape, Plaintiff's Exhibit 15.
Dramatic.
Terry Wilson to the conspirators in Lysine. No, 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 no. The way to do that is go to those meetings, and if we need to meet, which we will, you just, one person will get a suite. Okay, and then quietly tell everybody I'm meeting at 2 in my suite, and you come to this suite. It's done away from the official. That's what we submit as evidence, the plan that occurred in HFCS, and that's why we think that the CRA was used as a cover for conspiratorial meetings. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much for both counsel for their excellent arguments, and we'll move